This is the Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. We're on location. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and Susanna Case is here. My favorite Susanna is here, and she's going to tell you why with a poem.
Okay, so I'm going to start with the first poem from If This Isn't Love, which kind of sets the stage for why the book is focused on the telenovela, at least as a frame. And this is Love Stories for Girls. Every distortion I learned about love came from romance comics and later telenovelas. I blame the words love at first sight, walking in the rain, walking on beaches, dancing on beaches, red sports cars. I blame messages about the unimportance of a career, unrealistically perfect bodies, and men with full heads of hair. I blame super long eyelashes and the negative portrayal of eyeglasses, the idea of nice girls. I blame kissing. Really, kissing fries the brain, and afterward, everyone ends up in love with an inappropriate person, and they're never the same again. I blame makeup that tears never smear. I blame tears.
Now you know what I mean. And how she ends a poem makes us want to go on to the next poem. What is the title of this book?
If this isn't love, and there is which is a song title, actually.
How did you get that perfect title for this book? When did that occur to you?
Probably when I was writing the title poem for the book, but possibly not. I write a lot about the experience of young girls and young women. So, of course, love relationships are a big part of that, or at least they were for me. And so I knew love had to be in the title, even though it's very difficult to use love in a poem. Love, heart, all those kinds of words there. Mm-hmm. They can be dangerous to use.
That's the point. And that title sets us up because of the word isn't. We know right away it's going to be a riff on love, the margins of love. We know right away it's going to have something sardonic about it. And it is actually the title is a work of art. You don't disappoint us. Well, last night I read it again. I had read it a couple of times, but I wanted to brush up on my Shakespeare. And after I finished, Susanna, I wanted more, and I ate a jelly sandwich. Really? So read us a poem.
Okay, well, there's 13 telenovela poems that frame the other poems in the book, and they're inspired by an Italian telenovela, Un Posto al Sole, which is and has been for many years extremely popular in Italy. And this is telenovela one. I don't spit on the plate where I eat. The son, without steady work, explains to his worried father in a long-running soap opera, an Italian proverb that sends me to the internet. They drink wine on their patio off the Golfo di Napoli. Yesterday, I was on another patio, a restaurant off Arthur Avenue. A woman with a Bronx accent was so loud, we decided to move inside where Andrea Bocelli was singing Cante Partero on the mixtape. In Puglia, I heard this song during a church service. Loved it so much, I emailed the priest to ask the song's name, carefully checking that my Italian was correct. He never responded. Silly American to email a priest about a pop song of love and goodbyes. Leaving our patio seats started a movement. The tables emptied out. Everyone then enjoyed their wine in the air conditioning, listened to Andrea Bocelli, except for the loudmouth still on the patio and her friends. When Andrea Bocelli sang in front of the Duomo in Milano during the lockdown, that video with all the silenced cities of the world, Music for Hope, made everyone cry as if soap were burning their eyes. We watched the death count going up. Watch the Italian family at the center of the telenovela, who live in Posillipo overlooking Vesuvius. The purses are big and voluptuous. Everyone is serious. The only one smiling is the girlfriend of the married doctor who wants to rid himself of a stalker wife. The girlfriend likes his new apartment. Her walk is springy. Uh-oh, she's in love. She hasn't a clue.
Oh,
and that line is a kind of of the collection.
It certainly is. So the telenovela, that was number one. And tell us about how the counterpoints of the telenovela poems against the speaker's reality poems in the book.
I try to think about the themes of the telenovela and then from that create riffs on the themes that were not telenovela based, even though some of the peculiarities of experience in those poems mirrored the telenovela poems.
That is the brilliance of this book. So we have the epitomized ultra Italian passionate lust, greed, betrayal, and then we have the speaker's reality, which actually, and this is why it's so smart. In the telenovela, there's always a nugget of truth. Mm-hmm. Because fantasy has to be based, has to have tethers of truth. And because there are little kernels of reality there, that makes the other poems, the counterpoint, so vivid. So the placing, I'm so glad you didn't put all the tele poems together. Was that a choice?
Yes. Yeah, no, I wanted them as a frame, but I didn't want it to be a book only on the telenovela.
Right. So when I'm retired in Pinecrest Rest Haven, I'm going to take all your telenovelas out and chart the storyline, because there is a storyline there with the same characters and they get worse and worse. But since they are peppered throughout the book, they just make wonderful punctuation poems.
Well, these telenovela stories have been going on for years and years. The characters have aged. This is a series that has been popular for over 26 years now. So characters that started off young are no longer. Oh. So
let's hear some more. And some more things about love from this book. I want everyone to know that you have 9 books of poetry. And this, If This Isn't Love, just came out 2023, last year. And Susanna Case has won the Pinnacle Book Achievement Awards, an IPPY, a New York City Big Book Award Distinguished Favorite Award, finalist twice, an honorable mention for the Eric Hoffer Book Award, finalist for the American Fest. Oh, I'm getting too tired. And the International Book Awards. Let us hear a poem.
Okay, so this is one that people seem to like a lot and sometimes think is funny, but it's not really funny. It's meant to be very serious, actually. And it's called Brothel. My student Lisa invites me to staff the front desk nights, says I won't have much to do in the Upper East Side apartment where she turns tricks, and I can get a book out of it. I'm already titling it Brothel, envision scribbling through the slow hours, pages piling up, tenure or better, a bestseller. But I've been trying to work on my marriage to a husband more jealous than Othello, who keeps track of my every hour. She's going on about the wealthy oil man who a group of the girls peed on last night, and I interrupt to regretfully reject the offer, probably a mistake, because Brothel would sell more copies than my poetry books, and my marriage blows up later anyway, like anything with contents under pressure put to the flame. Her pimp, someone who scares me, walks into my office as if he owns her, me, even the university. He ignores everything except for Lisa, says not a word. She rushes her stuff together, follows him out, head bent in submission. And I think about how tough she looked as she laughed about the John sprawled on the floor.
What a powerful statement. That poem is couched in situation. And also the speaker becomes an anti-hero there, the innocent. in the poem, which is a really interesting point of view, because, I mean, it's really a dangerous, dirty place for the speaker to be. And yet, it's sort of the wonder of it all. Let's have more.
Okay. So this, there are some love poems in this collection. They're not sort of classical love poems, I'd have to say. And
I think love triumphs in this book.
Well, I try to do that. This is Invasive Species, a love poem. And the poem mentions the Pablo Escobar hippos, which at the time I wrote this poem, there were 100 of them. And last time I checked, there were 140. So they have been rapidly increasing in population to the point where they're being airlifted out and sent to other places. So this is Invasive Species, a love poem. A woman mistakes a bath bomb for soap and turns a shade of pink she can't scrub off for days, declares she loves the product anyway. Like water, horses, hippos who turn pink in the sun from oily fluids secreted by their glands, moisturizer for dry hippo skin. I've been slathering oils on myself this winter, orangey rosemary, to avoid feeling hippo-like when you touch me. One's lover shouldn't be too dry. A folkloric painted ceramic hippo perches atop our television cabinet. Head bent, its eyes seem to follow us. We joke it's FBI with an embedded listening device, zeroing in on two ex-hippies. A bad pun, but anything seems possible in this year turned inside out. Why not a pink-mouthed hippo spy? Hippos are bad-tempered. At all costs, they will defend their turf. Pablo Escobar, drug lord, kept four hippos on his Colombian estate. After he died in a shootout, they stayed too heavy to move. Yet temper didn't prevent crazed love. 100 cocaine hippo descendants float their lives away in Escobar's Hacienda Napoles, now a park. I love hippos despite the havoc they create, as you love me, my skin rubbed pink from the bath. Another hungry animal that doesn't belong where she's found, wet, cranky, digging in.
So satisfying. She writes like a dancer moves. And in the book, there are poems, so many poems of travel. I can just remember Italy, London, Chile, Ireland, Guatemala, Sweden, Budapest. That's what I can remember.
India, I think.
Oh, excuse me, and Wyoming.
Oh, Greece. Greece is, I do travel a lot. And so those places become inspiration for me.
How many countries have you been to? A dozen.
I think over 60, maybe 80. Over 60.
There are 60 countries in the world? Yeah. Outside of Trenton? Oh, my God. I'm so domestic. Well, my question for you is how travel serves the poems, because travel's a paradigm, it's a compression with people. Does that affect the poem, or is travel just this beautiful backdrop that you're able to drop the characters into, or does it really have a device?
It's both. It's a backdrop sometimes. It gives, from my point of view, some flavor and detail to what I'm writing about when I might not be writing specifically travelogue, which I'm generally not writing. But sometimes it is the subject of the poem. I started out as an anthropology student, so I'm always interested in other cultures, and that interest threads its way through my work. Certainly.
Oh, I didn't know that you were an anthropologist.
Well, I was never an anthropologist, but I was an anthropology student.
I knew you were a substitute teacher.
I was, yes, because you read that poem.
And many other things. Well, read us two poems together and let us have enough.
Okay. I'll read this one, and then I'll read a travel one. This one is Frank O'Hara tells the mothers of America to let their kids go to the movies. My mother half obeyed, said okay, but only every other week. That had more to do with a belief in fresh air than a revolt against content. But it meant I missed The Blob until the remake. What I did get to see was two women, after having to stick out my chest and lie about my age to a dubious matron who decided not to care. Two women, the movie in which after her rape, a girl's hair suddenly was longer, a filmmaking error. Don't worry, the creep was killed. Even in the fertile hills of Italia, women were traumatized and hungry. Ah, De Sica, or was it Carlo Ponti, or was Carlo Ponti the reason that in every scene with Sophia Loren, which was almost every scene in the film, her makeup was perfect? I bet it was Ponti, who so publicly loved her. Everybody loved Sophia Loren and still loves her. I loved her so much, I barely noticed Jean-Paul Belmondo with his intellectual communism, so romantic in a man. Only later did I fall in love with him. I wanted to grow up with breasts like Sophia's, preferably in Lazio, not Queens, New York. Even more, I wanted to learn how to fight for myself, like Sophia did, in the midst of all the deprivations of wartime. Of course, Frank O'Hara was right. Kids need to see lots of movies. How else will girls learn what it takes? So, like all the poems in between the telenovela poems, there's truth in that poem. And then the aim is to try to get it some kind of larger version of that truth. This is one of the poems that's set in another country in India, The Fortune Teller on the Deccan Plateau. He points out, I have one snake eye, meaning intelligent but duplicitous, and I ask if the love I have will last as he wraps his cobra gently around me, weighty and cold. The cobra hoods its neck ribs and hisses. Like a landlocked narwhal without wherewithal is how I feel, like a startled toddler with coal-lined eyes staring. I, who thought to be able to connect to anyone anywhere, am at a loss, toes dipped stubbornly in the sand. My hair is falling out from a poor diet. Worse, everyone is dying. Back home, female cancers in three, Lizzie, Susan, Bonnie, the man I lived with before the man I live with, gone. I miss my crew, but what can I do about any of it, about that dead ex-lover? Is it best to cut off love when it isn't enough? The fortune teller doesn't know, with his long white beard, silver rings on every finger, only responds, we love the way we've been loved.
You know, that last line can go a long way in life. Mm-hmm. There's nothing wrong with that last line. We could live by it, right?
Well, it is. I mean, it's true. I mean, every psychologist and sociologist knows that that's true.
She has five chapbooks, and The Scottish Cafe was released in English-Polish version and also English-Ukrainian. How did you get to those states?
Well, it was my first collection. I won the Slappering Hall Press chapbook competition for the English version. And then some years later, I was contacted by a translator, Sir Warren Mikoza in California, who didn't know me, but he said he had been reading the book and he felt compelled to translate it, and how would I feel about it? And I was like, yes, please do that. And he was a Polish national, although he was living in California and still had some connections in Poland. So the University of Opole picked it up. And it's interesting, the contract that I signed was totally in Polish. I had no idea what I was giving away, but signed it anyway. And then was invited to go to Poland to read the poems, which was also a very, I had not been to Poland before, although my mother's side of the family, her father emigrated from Warsaw, but I had never been there, and went to Wrocław to a conference and read the poems and just asked for somebody else, please, to read them in the Polish version because I don't know a word of the language. So it was a fascinating experience for me. And it was the first time I had traveled alone in a very long time, because I had always done that as a younger woman, but more recently I had traveled with partners. So it was suddenly being thrust into the travel alone mode again, a very different one, particularly for a woman, particularly for an older woman. And so,
why are you not afraid of the world?
A good question. I don't really know, because growing up as a child, my parents, they never took me anywhere. But I think there was always that curiosity. And when I was a teenager of 16, my mother, it was very popular at that time for young girls to get their noses fixed. And my mother asked me, did I want my nose fixed? I said, no, I don't want my nose fixed. I want a trip. So
good answer. And where did your nose take you?
My father took me to Mexico, which is the first.
Oh, so we add Poland and Mexico to my little list. Yes, there is actually a poem about your riding in a car about your father, with your father. So I think it's just in your DNA, though. I think you just came in kind of adventurous and maybe a little rebellious and strong spirited.
Yes, a little. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. It's all there. And so we want to hear more. Another poem from If This Isn't Love.
This is about my mother, and it's called My Halfway House. My mother never went really anywhere, as you will hear in the poem. My mother sang opera off key while she worked in her kitchen, favored Pagliacci, A Story of Entanglement. The dissonance irritated me as a teenager, but became part of what I hold close, the longing for what itches most after it's gone, for the woman who never got to use her passport. Have a career, she advised. It's less boring. I had a primeval fear she would devour me, like the gerbil mother I once observed in a tank who meticulously consumed all her babies. Have your own money. Don't depend on any man. The colonized body has two choices, and either way, la commedia è finita. Lie down with the devil. Don't lie down. There will be nothing when you run out of figs. You will be like the fireflies, practically gone.
Did she actually say run out of figs?
No.
Because that's a gorgeous line, and it is just too good for words. And the colonized body, what a great phrase. Where is the Italian in your world? Because you're just immersed with Italian language and Italian experiences. I thought you might be half Italian.
I'm not. There isn't a single, I don't know. I've never done any DNA, and who knows who rode, what handsome man rode through on a horse at some point in the ancestry of my family. But in theory, there is no Italian in
there. But you've adopted it as something central to your life.
It's a beautiful language. I have tried learning various languages and unsuccessfully, and I decided after a period of giving up that I wasn't going to give up, that I was not going to die knowing only one language, and went to school to study Italian, and then eventually hired one of the teachers to be my private tutor because it was just easy, it was just a more of an intensive. And I have been studying with him for over 10 years now.
And you are some determined poet. What you get your hands around something, you do that something.
I wanted to be able also to read and understand Italian poetry. It's not that I go to Italy. Well, I do go to Italy. I've been to Italy many times, but it's not that I go all that often to warrant choosing Italian, except that it is a beautiful language, and it was one that I hadn't yet tried and
failed. Well, we want this book translated into Italian, but I'll tell you, poetry in Italy stopped in the 50s. I mean it. There's no action going on there. It is very painful for me to see.
Well, some of my poems have been in Italian magazines, several different Italian magazines.
Oh, that's good.
So, but what you say is actually very close to what a poet I know in Rome has said. She has also said there's no poetic action.
So. I think I know who she is. And Maura?
No.
Is it Maura Egan? Okay. That whatever action there is in Rome is generated by a couple of people. It is really frightening. There's not being taught. Poetry is not being taught in the universities. There are not bookstores. There are not workshops. A friend of mine is a poet, and she tries to generate some activity, but it is a wonder. It is just a wonder, isn't it? Well, I want to switch.
I just want to say my Italian tutor, who graduated from the University of Perugia, told me that the only poets he studied at university were dead ones.
Oh, this is exactly right. My books here don't go beyond the 50s, right? So we're going to switch gears for a minute and talk about a fabulous project you've been engaged in with Margot Stever. And it is about Marilyn Monroe, the goddess of love. Please describe it.
Yes, this is 91 poets, living and dead, writing about, including you, Grace, writing about Marilyn from many different perspectives. People think of Marilyn as a kind of bimbo figure, but it's a misrepresentation. Actually, she was quite smart. She was a good business person. She had some unfortunate love relationships, but in her business life, she did take care of herself.
Well, do you have a poem that you wrote that's in that book?
I do. I have written a few about Marilyn, who has fascinated me, I think, the way some women in history have also fascinated you. And this one is inspired by one of her movies, Niagara, which is one of my favorite of her movies, is Some Like It Hot. But but this is also for me Niagara was a wonderful movie. And she played a figure, a very vampy hot chick called Rose Loomis, and her husband in the film was George Loomis, who's mentioned in the poem, was played by Joseph Cotten. And then another of the characters, Polly Cutler, who was a very kind of pragmatic character, it was played by Jean Peters. So this is Atomic Blonde. A woman labeled a tramp in a tight dress in the first half of any 1953 movie is going to be dead by its second half. Like in Niagara, Marilyn playing vampy Rose Loomis, passion kissing her lover behind a barrier to the falls, the water a symbol of rutting life force if ever there were one, is later strangled by her husband George in revenge. I had that husband, too, who'd already tried to cut off my air at home, a pillow over my face. This wasn't a film, and I fought back. Why were we at Niagara on vacation? I'd left the lover in New York City to kiss and mess around with on my return. No intent to coax him into a killing by a waterfall. I wanted only to be pushed out, too indecisive by nature just to leave. But in this marriage, I always had to do the cleaning up. not a femme fatale. I was more the Polly Cutler type, the one who takes a first aid kit on vacation to soothe all possible injuries. But my George Loomis didn't steal a boat and drop to his end over the falls. When we got home, I got the papers and he signed them.
Those last lines of yours that are one syllable words are really incredible. And he signed them. Boom, 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 boom. You really know what it takes. You really know how to use those one syllables to end a poem. And now we're going to have a final poem from this, If This Isn't Love. And please write another book, because I cannot keep eating jelly sandwiches to satisfy my life. And we are going to have another program on Marilyn Monroe with you and Margot whenever we get a schedule cleared.
Okay.
So let's have a final poem from this present book. And so I will show you the title.
Thank you, Grace. And I love the cover of that book, which was painted by my friend Mervyn Taylor, who did been on your program as well. And it picks up so many of the themes from the manuscript. The red car, there's a poem about the blue dress, there's a TV for the telenovela. So it was just perfect, I thought. So this is the title poem, If This Isn't Love. Eating nachos covered with Velveeta cheese in a diner in Wyoming, we're hungry, and all the menu offerings are a little off like that. Earlier, at Bear Lodge Butte, we watched a snake eat a nestful of baby birds. The fear chirps silenced one by one, mother crying out as she bombarded the predator, trying to block it. She had built her nest too low. In an indigenous myth, the rock rose from the ground to protect young girls from giant bears. And I wonder how high off the ground one needs to be if our first floor apartment in New York City can shield us. Before we left for this vacation, a man stormed into our building, waving a gun around the hallway, jealous that his woman had found a better man to sleep with in the apartment by the stairs. The reality is, there's no true protection from projectiles, nor from the hungry or the maniacs. I want your arms around me anyway. Velveeta, unpalatable, like me, a congealing mess in badly air-conditioned heat.
The inimitable voice of Susanna Case with If This Isn't Love. And this is The Poet and the Poem. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media Production, post-production by Mike Turpin, MAT Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making the program possible. Funding is provided by the Zynipid Fund, the Rivada Foundation, Anne Arundel Arts Council, the Song in the Room Women, Natalie Canavore, and Sandy Jackson Cohen. Mike Turpin's our engineer, and I'm Grace Cavalieri.